Hello and welcome to Inside Property with me, Richard Blanco. Now, how important is furniture in interior design when renting or letting property? And how much value can it add to the proposition? Do you find yourself continuously in a sea of neutral colours, wondering if a splash of red or a feature wall could make your rental property look too personal? If you're a tenant, would you like more freedom to redecorate? Maybe you are despairing at the old tat that your landlord has left you, or that poor quality flat-packed wardrobe that is looking, well, pretty shaky. And we're seeing more boutique HMOs and build-to-rent developments with their contemporary shared communal spaces. What impact are these having on tenant expectations? Well, I'm joined in the studio by East London landlord Toby Scrutton, senior designer Nicola Geldart from furniture and design company David Phillips. And on the line from Leeds, we're joined by Julian Morris of Icon Living. Now, let me turn to you first, Nicola. Tell us a bit about what you do at David Phillips and, you know, the different kinds of services that you offer.
Yeah, of course. So at David Phillips, we're predominantly a furniture company, and we tend to offer landlords and owner-occupiers a fully furnished solution for their properties. We also offer rental schemes as well as replenishment services for that one-off piece of furniture that you need. In addition to that, we have a social living division which takes care of our student and contract side. And then we've also got our sister company, Milk, who do our very high-end bespoke interior design projects. And then I'm one of the interior designers for our build-to-rent division. So yes, David Phillips has a lot of divisions, but it is really exciting. So on the build-to-rent side, we tend to do a lot of high quantity apartments, so roughly maybe 200 units as a ballpark figure, all the way up to maybe 600, 700 units at a time in any new development across the UK, not just in London. We've got quite a lot of nice developments that have happened up in Manchester and up in Liverpool, so we're pretty nationwide as a company.
And, you know, is the name of the game neutrals when you're doing those sort of build-to-rent blocks?
Oh, that's still a topic of contention. So I tend to be personally a very neutral person. However, some designers on the team are very bold in colours, but it all just comes down to what the development wants to achieve. If they're trying to attract young professionals and young students, we tend to go for a more edgy, trendy vibe. We'll sometimes do often the sofa in a neutral colour because that's the largest piece in the living room, whereas the armchair can be in like a really bold burgundy or a nice emerald green. And then we'll usually bring in maybe like some brass or copper or chrome finishes just to sort of brighten the space up a bit. So it really does vary quite a lot, and it is a lot of the time down to not only just budget but also what the development wants to link in with their branding as well.
And are you seeing more and more of these sort of trendy shared spaces in those sorts of build to rent developments?
Yeah, definitely. A lot of places like to do communal spaces now purely because it adds that extra benefit to the building. Usually a lot of places have a concierge and a gym, but now there's a cinema that you can rent out for you and your friends to go to. There's a kids' room. There's sort of a setup similar to what Starbucks has, where you can come down, you can make yourself a coffee and you can sit and you can work, but there's other people around you. And they're trying to create, I guess, this vertical community where, you know, there's 700 people in the block, but everyone sort of knows each other because they all tend to meet in that communal space at some point during the day. So yeah, there is quite a big push for communal spaces nowadays.
Fantastic. Well, let me bring Julian in now, because Julian, you're known for specialising in HMOs. Tell us a bit about the kind of work you're doing to add value, I guess, to HMOs.
At the moment now, I work more with landlords and investors and I work with them on a consultancy basis normally, or on a training basis. So I teach people interior design, so people that are buying properties themselves and want to start managing the process themselves. I teach them principles of design, how to create great product, and we do look at things from a commercial basis. So it's looking at the commercial design, commercial interior design, looking at it from a commercial interior design perspective. And then I do kind of a consultancy work as well. So if somebody has a project they need help with, I tend to do ad hoc design work. So Skype consultations where I do layouts for people and look at color themes and look at furnishing layouts and furnishing specifications. So two things really is the training and then the consultancy.
And, you know, I often worry, Julian, about the sort of poor quality HMOs that are around, because there are still some, aren't there? I mean, do you think most landlords going into HMOs now understand that there is an expectation of, you know, more of a design element?
It's interesting because I see a lot of people asking, where's everybody gone? You know, they put an ad on to Spare Room, and they're saying, well, we've been putting ads on Spare Room for years, and all of a sudden we're not getting any inquiries anymore. And I just think there's some people that realize that there's a lot more competition out there, and because there's more competition, they need to up their game, and also they need to make their product stand out. I mean, if you look at simple economics, a lot of people teach differentiation when you're looking at getting involved in a competitive market. So it's making your product stand out. So some people realize that they're getting into a much more competitive environment, so they'll focus on design to make their product stand out. And other people, they don't really think about that. They think it's just getting, you know, where's everybody gone, or you know, we're finding it much more difficult, but they don't really put the two together. So you do seem to have a split between some investors who do realize that design is important and others that are just carrying on doing the same thing as they were before.
Do you think HMOs are having to compete with some of those build-to-rent projects that Nicola was telling us about?
Definitely. If you look at the student market, the landscape's totally changed over the last 10 years. And now these developers are moving into the professional HMO market. So definitely we're seeing that's the big competition coming up over the next 10 years. As Nicola has said, you know, they're doing a 650-room development. That's just one of many. And these companies are employing designers like Nicola. If you look at the high-end stuff, it's amazing. The big problem is the middle ground, where you're getting also a lot of product coming into the middle, which is also fairly well designed. So that's really the competition that I'm concerned with. I'm not really concerned about today's HMO landlord putting in, you know, whatever they do, because their product isn't going to be relevant in another 5, 6, 7 years' time. So really I'm focusing on the build-to-rent sector as being the main competition over the next few years. So, yeah, definitely, definitely. And they focus a lot on design. That's their big thing. That's what they focus on, is design and the experience, the customer experience. So, yeah, definitely.
Okay, interesting. Now, let me bring Toby in. You tend to rent to families, and you're not renting HMOs at all, are you? You've got a family business that's been in the family for over 100 years,
well,
I believe.
Also the fact the tenants are generational as well. So I've got many situations where I've got 4 or 5 members of one family's generation. So I've got grandparents, great-grandparents, grandchildren all the way through a variety of properties that I own, from flats to houses and so forth. So the families come with their own issues, so don't get me wrong about that, but because there's such a strong unit within the area, their design things, you see develop from what was old, you know, the old school development side of it where the parents were living. The kids have these wonderful ideas and it all integrates. And then you end up with the grandparents having their designs implemented by the children onto them as well. So you get this wonderful merry-go-round of constant change.
Well, what's quite interesting, I think, with your properties, and I've seen one or two of them, is you allow the tenants to design the property totally in the way that they want it. And sometimes you pay for or do some of that,
well,
don't
you? I believe that as a landlord that everyone's entitled to a decent home to live in. And if you allow someone to put their ideas on a property, then they will call it home. And home is far more important, that genre of what you call home. And they will look after it so much better. And because they feel it's home, you have all these other connotations that come out of it as well. They feel they're secure. They feel, you know, their families are welcome round. There's a general good vibe about the place. It has this whole extenuated circumstances that grow from them calling something home, because it's a real safe centre for them.
I mean, I have quite a lot of fears around letting tenants do their own design. I worry that they're going to use kind of really dark, strong colours, or that they're going to really bling the flat out and it's just not going to be to any other people's taste.
If you repaint a property, okay, so it's maybe £1,000 for a really bad job to repaint it. But in truth, you've probably made far more than that on the rental. I mean, I tend not to ask people to put black or red on the walls, because you just can't overpaint them. But generally, everything else goes.
So you do have certain kind of boundaries, you know, or certain things that you don't allow them
to do.
But
you've also got structural design, which I tend to generally try and steer them away from.
Right,
you, try you mean walls down
knocking walls down? Yeah. Right, okay.
Could you not do that this time? But because I develop properties, then I build the properties to maximise the space within them. So they get the most usable space out of the property that I can possibly build as a developer and builder. So they get that benefit already. And then obviously they get given a brand new property, which is refurbed.
I mean, what would you say, Toby, to a landlord, you know, who is reluctant to let tenants put shelves up, reluctant to let them paint walls at all, you know, because they're just worried they're going to do it in a poor quality and that it's going to need a lot of work afterwards?
Well, if you decide that you're going to have a relationship with this tenant and actually have a tenant for a period of time, then let them express themselves, because everyone is different and you have to embrace that. If you don't, they will never feel comfortable truly, and they will never want to truly live there for much, you know, for a long period of time. Now, as a landlord, you want people to live in your properties for a long period of time because it's so much better. So if you create an environment where you're happy and they're happy, it's a great relationship.
Yes, and it obviously makes good business sense, doesn't it?
We have no voids.
Not so often, I'd imagine.
No.
You never have voids, do you, Toby?
No.
Is that what you're telling me? No.
Not unless I engineer a void.
Okay, you're right.
But generally, my property can be relet with on the same day.
Right.
If I'm not taking it out of service to redevelop it.
Mm.
So voids are very, very, very minimal because I've got such long-term tenants.
Okay, fantastic. Let me come on to some more kind of general design questions. One topic that always comes up is what to put on the floors, Nicola, whether to go for laminates or spend that bit more and have solid wood floors, and, you know, whether to have carpet or not. I used to be a big fan of just stripping floors, and actually they're quite hard wearing, and that can be quite a good solution. But I find some tenants don't like the gaps between the floorboards, or they see it as rustic, whereas, you know, other tenants will see it as contemporary and trendy. So what's your advice on floors? What do you think you should be
absolutely.
Doing?
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely a very personal opinion, and also it depends on, you know, the durability of the actual product. Nowadays there are some fantastic laminates on the market that look like real wood. When you touch them, they feel like real wood, but they have the durability quality of a laminate, or even of a tile. You can get these lovely, like, porcelain ceramic tiles that look like wood, and that's obviously a great solution. They can be a little bit more expensive, but in terms of their longevity, it's much better than obviously a solid wood floor. Issue with solid wood floors as well, unless they're engineered, they're going to expand and contract with the heat and the cold. And in this kind of climate where we're experiencing a heat wave, but next week it might snow for all we know, you don't want to take that risk as well. For carpets, I usually just like to have a carpet in a bedroom. But also I really like the idea of like a soft little throw rug and some wood underneath it. I'm kind of Scandinavian in that sense, where you like step out in the morning on a nice little sheepskin kind of rug, and then you're onto hardwood flooring. I quite like that. So it is very preferential. Obviously for families with young children, carpet is a great solution because it's safe, especially on the staircases as well. So it is very personal opinion, but also there are a lot of great technologies on the market that are making things like wood flooring more affordable for a lot of people to use.
Now, Julian, obviously in HMOs, there are often kind of communal areas with quite a lot of kind of through traffic, people often use laminate in those sorts of areas. I've seen horrible cheap laminate sometimes that people use, and my heart sinks when I see it. You know, what's your tendency with floors? What do you tend to do?
Well, Nicola made a good point about durability. So one of the key decision makers for me when I'm looking at materials is durability. And until fairly recently, if you're looking at a wooden floor, you had, you know, very few options. It was laminate you'd strip the floors, or you put down a vinyl, which tears easily. But there's some new products that have come available. One of them in particular is a felt-backed anti-tear vinyl, which it goes down the same as a standard soft, you know, cushion-backed vinyl, but you just can't rip it. So it's a kind of semi-commercial product. And I've been using that more recently, and that's a fantastic product because it's, you know, it's very hard wearing, it's soft, it's warmer, and it just gives you that incredible durability, and you don't have problems with if it leaks, if you get a leak on it, it's gonna it's going to split, or you don't have the problems with temperature change, etc. So, you know, there are some great products around, but if it's for an HMO and you do have an open plan space and you've got water there, then you do have to be fairly careful. So you have to make sure that you've got a flat surface to put it on. So, you know, putting a self-leveling compound down, if it's a concrete, or if you're putting it down over a wooden floor, then you need to put down a fluorine grade ply before you put down the finishing surface. So it helps to speak to a good retailer and really think about how long you want the product to last and how it's going to be used. So, but I think for me, I think this new felt mat vinyl, which is an anti-tear vinyl, I think is probably the best product that you can use at the moment for communal spaces and for open plan spaces, because it does give you that look of wood, the durability of, let's say, something like Karndean, but it's a lot cheaper and easier to fit.
Now, I'm just thinking, Julian, the kitchen is obviously a very important part of an HMO, isn't it? And, you know, I always think with kitchens, you can spend anything from 3,000 to probably 300,000, actually, couldn't you? How much is it worth spending on your kitchen in an HMO?
Well, again, when you look at design, for me, it's more about how the space is going to be used and thinking about the durability of the space, the functionality of the space, and also how long it's going to be appealing for. So you've got several different elements at play. You've got the aesthetic element, which you want to last. You want the actual units themselves to last, and you want the design itself to work well for the people that are using it. So there are lots of elements. So I tend to get, I use Howdens for my kitchens, but
yes, me too. I do as well. Yes.
Yeah. The problem is they never design it right. So I get them to come out, measure, and then I spend time sitting down with the people at the warehouse planning out the layout. And I also make sure that the kitchen is fully stripped out before putting anything back in, and I get good quality fitters in. Because that adds to durability. And on the odd occasion, I have gone to a bespoke company, German companies, who have got great designers who can create something a bit more bespoke and more durable. So, it really does. There's so many elements at play, but I think durability, functionality and aesthetics are the three main things to think about when you're looking at a kitchen.
Yes, Nicola, let me come on to you with kitchens. I mean, how high end is it worth going, particularly if it's for a let property? Obviously, we want it to be decent and durable. Does that mean spending more, or does it mean getting a good kind of medium price product, or should we go more value so it can be replaced in a few years?
Yeah, not necessarily. Like, there are some great companies that are specifically focused on sort of like commercial grade residential kitchens, and they're the kind of people that will come into sort of the buildings that I tend to work on, and they'll be able to furnish 200 kitchens, and you know, they'll stand the test of time to a certain extent. I mean, it just depends on how often they're being used. Personally, I see a huge deal, like Julian touched on, it depends on how someone is actually going to use the kitchen. Do they want the kitchen to be the showpiece, but they actually just order in nice food every evening? Do they actually use their kitchen, or are they the family that have everyone over for Christmas and have to cook for 30 people once a year? Do they need a massive oven? There are so many things that go into the kitchen, and it is really a very, very personal thing, based on how the family and the people that use it actually function in that kitchen, because, you know, it's sort of been a very cliche thing, but the kitchen is really the centre of the home at the end of the day.
And are we still doing islands, or are they out these days? What's happening?
I love a good island. I love a good island. I mean, it definitely just depends on the space. Sometimes you have to put an island in because there's nowhere else for counter space. But yeah, they can be really nice, especially with some lovely bar stools. A nice little waterfall feature of the countertop going down to the floor is always nice. So yeah, I don't have an issue with kitchen islands.
Toby, you know, you're a seasoned landlord. How much do you spend on appliances? Do you tend to, are you one of these landlords who goes for the expensive ones?
I won't do appliances because
you don't do them, all right.
Well, no, because it's such a personal choice of. I mean, the kitchen is the second biggest expense after buying the house. You have to give someone a good enough blank canvas that they can develop it, but it has to have the design element in it to be attractive in the first place. It's got to have appeal, and it's also got to have that, well, when will it go out of date and will it break first? So you get your kitchen so it won't break, and you think, well, as a landlord, is it every 10 years you change your kitchen and bathroom, or is it less? Is it every 5? And then you work out from that how often you want to change it. Now, if you go for quite a white kitchen with wood worktops, they last A, very well, but they also stand the test of time. They never go out of fashion. If you want a purple kitchen or a yellow kitchen, or you can get your passing fad and you find yourself going down a rabbit hole because you have to replace it because the next tenant coming in goes, do you know what? That's really horrible.
Yes, it's true.
Rightly so.
So the design has to be clever enough that it has curb appeal for the tenant to walk into and go, a wow factor, but it has to have enough space within it that they can put their own things in it. Now, people love stainless steel, some people love white, some people love black appliances, some, you know, that element, again, of them investing a little in the property brings in that whole point of they're not going to do anything to the property, you know, in terms of detriment. It'll always be positive.
Okay, well, if you have any thoughts on this or any other topics we're discussing today, do let us know via the website insideproperty.org.uk. You're listening to Inside Property with me, Richard Blanco, and my guest, Toby Scrutton of Scrutton Estates, senior designer at David Phillips, Nicola Geldart, and Julian Morris from Icon Living. Now, Julian, I tend to have a policy where I will replace my appliances, you know, if they stop working after 5 years. I tend to sort of buy, you know, most stuff costs me about £250, that sort of price. You know, do you think that's a sensible strategy or should I be spending a bit more on them?
So when I'm looking at choice of appliances for an HMO, it's slightly different for me when you're when opposed to an unfurnished single let. But I need to really think about two things. The first of all is how long that appliance is going to last. So I need to look at a brand with a good reliability, you know, that's known for reliability, first of all. The second thing I need to think about is health and safety. So gas hobs are a no-no for me. And so I tend to specify things like induction hobs because you don't get any heat from them. So I also don't get problems with scorched splashbacks or whatever. So, you know, I have to think about the durability of the appliance. I also need to think about how easy they are to understand and use. So I don't want to get something with too many knobs and buttons on it that needs you need a big instruction manual to learn how it works. So, you know, again, the decision isn't as straightforward as you think. If you want to design a great product that, you know, people are going to enjoy using. So, you know, from my perspective as a landlord, I don't want to have to replace things too often. I don't want people to catch fire to the place. And I also want them to be able to understand it without me having to give them a lot of instructions. So those are really my main decisions. The price is fairly irrelevant because it has to fit into that criteria first. Then I think about price.
Right, okay, that sounds sensible. And Nicola, I wanted to move on to bathrooms. You know, is that the one area where we should forget about colour? You know, should we be neutral there and just go for those classic beiges and stone type shades?
Not necessarily. I kind of think that the bathroom is sort of something that you really can have much more fun with. I mean, take, for example, when you're out at a restaurant, there's so many times when I've gone into a bathroom there and come out to my girlfriends and said, you have to go check out the bathroom before we leave. They can be really big statement pieces. And that's not just in restaurants, but residential as well. There are some beautiful bathrooms I've seen in homes where you've come in and they've just got this gorgeous tiling detail, some really nice fixtures, a really statement sort of sink. And yeah, you definitely can have a lot more fun. And also, because it's a place you can close the door to, you know, it gives that wow factor when people actually come into your home and see your bathroom. And yeah, it's a place that you can spend similar amounts of money if you're going all white that you can on colour as well. So no harm.
And I'm just thinking tiles are an opportunity perhaps for adding a bit of colour, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, your standard subway tile, which is a design that I don't think is ever going to go out of fashion, that is in every spectrum of colour in the rainbow. So it's an easy way to inject some colour in your home without it costing a lot of money either.
How are you with accent walls, you know, feature walls, Nicola? Are they out now or can we still do those?
Oh, I still love accent walls.
Yes.
Yeah, I still love a good accent wall. I mean, we see them in a lot of places. It's a nice way to obviously create a focal point in the room and let people inject a little bit of colour without, you know, as Toby said, paint the whole room red. So they can have their slight little column in red and then leave it as is. So yeah, it is a nice option, definitely.
Now, Julian, bathrooms obviously get a lot of use in HMOs. And I'm just, you know, thinking of all of my issues I've had over the years with mould and not getting enough ventilation in and so on. So I must admit, I tend to be a bit utilitarian and pragmatic with bathrooms. Do you find yourself being the same or do you spend a bit more on design in them?
Well, I have to say that both Nicola and Toby have been giving some fantastic advice, and it does, and it all rings true with what I'm doing as well. So I think I'm stuck in the middle. I'm not really looking at being ultra trendy, because there are other people that can do that, are much better at that than I am. And I also think that I don't want to make my product too trendy, because the only thing that can happen with trend is it goes out of fashion. So I think you have to tend to be a little bit restrained when you're looking at design. However, as Nicola said, bathrooms are great places to add colour and to be a little bit creative, because while the bedrooms, you want to give your customers space and the opportunity to put their own put their own mark on it, as Toby said, if you make a space your home, then you're much more likely to stay in it. So you want to be restrained in the bedroom areas in HMOs, but you do want to add innovation and give the wow factor in other areas, and you've got that opportunity in the communal spaces and in the kitchens and the bathrooms. So I pretty much go totally mental in bathrooms and do things like paint ceilings black and put flashes of color in and paint recesses in bright colors. I think that's where you can be innovative. But in terms of durability, well, just because you can be creative doesn't mean you can't create a space that's durable. So in terms of the materials, you just want to be careful what materials you specify. If you're painting a room, then you want to paint it in a water resistant paint. If you're using tiles and you're using grouts, well, you don't want to use white grouts and white tiles, because they're going to show the muck a lot easier. So you do have to think about the materials very closely when you're looking at bathrooms and kitchens, because they do take a lot of wear and tear. And I don't do a lot of en-suites, so my bathrooms are used by 2-3 people all the time. So yeah, you do have to think a lot about the materials and the durability, but that's got nothing to do with being creative and being innovative.
Moving on to gardens, Toby. I mean, these used to be a bit sort of the bane of my life, because there's the challenge of trying to get the tenant to look after the garden, isn't there? So I've got this kind of, I do a bit of paving stones now, a patio and a lawn, and provide a lawnmower and hope that the tenant will be able to look after the lawn. What do you tend to do with gardens? Are you one of these landlords that just concretes the whole thing?
No, when I redevelop the place, I will give them a patio that's a decent size so they can have table and chairs out and a barbecue, and I will either give them, if the garden's a reasonable size, probably a decked area as well, but I will not do lawns. Lawns are particularly hard. I mean, obviously at the moment there's nothing left of them, but people either love a lawn or they hate them. And those who love the lawns will duly tend them and spend hours and hours looking after them. But that's about 1 in 100. Now, give them a border, put a few shrubs in it that'll go, and you can look after it and you've got a nice garden. Put some pots out that they can fill up with lavender or whatever they want. And they'll use the garden, and they don't have to spend too much time doing the work, but they will enjoy it. And it's so much simpler but a lawn is a no-no.
Very interesting. Good advice there. And Nicola, another kind of bugbear of mine is window dressings. It doesn't come very naturally to me, I have to say. But there's obviously, roller blinds, Roman blinds, and various kinds of curtains. I always find bay windows really tricky as well. I mean, what advice can you offer us on that sort of issue?
So in terms of blinds versus curtains, blinds are obviously tend to be much more durable in terms of curtains. You can usually get materials that you can sort of wipe clean and things like that. So for landlords, they tend to be a better fit than a curtain. You can get blackouts for both curtains and blinds, so that isn't really much of an issue when you're picking them. It just depends. Curtains tend to give a more homely feel. You obviously have a much more extensive choice of fabrics that you can choose from, so it does give that bit of personality. But if you just want something that's going to last and going to do the job, then blind is sort of your answer. Bay windows... yeah, that's still a tough one, even for me. I usually...
Well, that's reassuring to hear.
typically, you tend to see like a curtain rod that will go all the way around, and there'll sort of be panels of curtains at sort of each section of the window, basically.
I've done Roman blinds, actually, that work quite well.
They are a tricky thing. I think it's sort of trial and error sometimes, unfortunately. I still haven't found out what works for me, and sometimes it also depends on the home as well, because then... you get like these gorgeous Victorian bay windows, and then, you know, you have to really find something that will suit it and complement it as well, but also be functional. So yeah, unfortunately, I don't have great advice on the bay windows. But
sometimes people seem to have those kind of shutter style, almost like Venetian wooden blinds on bay windows.
Yeah, I find that that's becoming a really popular thing at the moment as well, especially when I walk around my area, I see a lot of those shutter blinds. And yeah, they're a really good option, but they do block out all the light. So you know, that can also be tricky as well. If you want to have some natural light coming in, but you want privacy, it's difficult with shutter blinds to get that. So,
moving on to more sort of practical issues and maybe dilemmas that landlords may face. I've seen situations sometimes where, you know, a property is being let very quickly and the agent has said, don't worry, we'll get your property furnished within 3 days. And I can just imagine all of this really terrible quality sort of flat pack stuff being thrown together. Does that happen much? He says, I'm sure you're not guilty of that, Nicola, but tell me what happens in those sorts of situations.
Well, specifically speaking about David Phillips, I mean, we're a company that have £2 million worth of stock in our warehouse at Beckton. So we do next day delivery if we can. So in terms of that, like specifically for David Phillips, we can turn around a scheme really quickly. And, you know, all our furniture, it's good quality. It's not flat pack. So in that regards, yes, we can do it. Obviously, it can be an issue for a lot of retailers. And we like to think at David Phillips that we're sort of ahead of the game in that offering.
Fantastic. Now, Julian, to furnish or not to furnish, I mean, when I first started in the business, I kind of felt that I had to furnish everything because it sort of looked better when it was furnished. And then I'd get that classic thing where I'd get a really great tenant who didn't want any furniture. And I mean, I rent in East London and it feels like more and more tenants have got their own furniture. What's your gut instinct these days? Do you always furnish? Do you part furnish? Do you not furnish? What do you tend to do?
Well, it does depend on the product. So you've got lots of different strategies that we're talking about here. So you've got on the one end of the market, you've got the standard single buy to let, which there are two options that you can go for depending on the demand. So there's furnished and unfurnished. And Toby quite sensibly has gone down the unfurnished route, which I would probably tend to do if I was going to get into single lets. Then you've got HMOs, which hands down have to be furnished because that's the type of product that it is. You're dealing with people that want somewhere to move straight into and they want that convenience. So an HMO has to be furnished. And obviously there are various levels that you can do them to. Then you've got serviced accommodation, which again is a step up from HMOs like holiday lets and people that are contractors. So that's again furnished. So I would say it really does depend on the market that you're going into, really.
Do you think it's different in different parts of the country, Julian? I just wonder if that, you know, in some parts of the country, there's more of an expectation that people want furniture.
No, not for HMOs.
Okay, yeah, no, interesting.
If you don't furnish, there are plenty of people that advertise. You go onto Spare Room, you might see the odd advert where they say, well, you'll see a picture of an unfurnished room, but you'll always see it says furnished bedroom. So they'll have a picture of an unfurnished room, but they'll say it's a furnished room because that is the type of product that it is. And, you know, an HMO is a space where somebody wants somewhere to move into that is a furnished space. If you don't furnish it, then you're going to just find it. It takes you a lot longer. You're going to have to find there are very few people looking for unfurnished HMOs, shared accommodation. So you are taking a risk if you do that. It might save you some money, but then you're going to be waiting a lot longer to rent the room.
And what about this issue of landlords leaving their sort of old tat in properties, you know, just stuff that they don't want anymore and they think, oh, this bed will do for the let property or this table will do. I mean, I despair when I see it myself because I think, you know, the tenant is going to see that and think you don't give a damn about them. And so why should they care about your property? What advice would you give to landlords on that, Julian?
Well, you said it there. You said that, you know, first of all, you personally think it doesn't look that great. But secondly, the customer's going to look at it and think, well, that person really doesn't care about, you know, the business that he's in and they don't really care about me. So if you do that, then that is what your customers are going to think. And ultimately, I think the difference between doing single lets and the more advanced strategies like HMOs, etc., it's more competitive. And what your customer thinks is extremely important if you want the product to perform properly. So, you know, it's irrelevant what you might think. If you think, well, it's my old chest of drawers, it'll be all right, fine. But if the customer isn't going to think very much of it, then well, then that's what you're doing. You're doing something that's not going to look very good from your customer's perspective. So by all means, go ahead, but then don't moan if you find that it's difficult to rent the space.
Now, thinking about the owner-occupier and, you know, getting a designer in for our own homes, Toby, have you ever had a designer in to do, like, the place where you and your family live?
Yes.
Have you? Oh, tell us a bit about it.
Turns out my uncle's wife was a designer. So she, when we first bought our house, she turned up and said, right, what are you going to do to the place? And I said, well, I'm going to pretty much demolish it to start with, but then I'll rebuild it. And she said, well, you want to consider sort of how you, the apertures of the house, the layout and the rest of it. And so she spent what I consider a bit too long telling me what I more or less knew. But yeah, it does, because having a designer in opens your eyes a little bit to what is possible, because you don't know it all by any means. And so just having that input can make you see it in a different light and give you sort of, you know, it's the use now. I tend to build houses that have very open plan ground floors, and the lounge must be seen from the kitchen, because a young child should not be in a kitchen when the parents are in it. So by having a fairly open plan base, child can be playing in a pen or whatever when they're very small, out of the kitchen, parents can be in the kitchen cooking dinner, and there's no interaction for danger. So, and then then that has a much bigger family area, because, as we said, kitchen is the heart of the home.
And that's the sort of stuff you've learned from designers, by the sounds of it. Yeah.
So by opening up that ground floor, you suddenly have this space that's in use all the time. There's no dead space downstairs anymore. It's always all in use all of the time.
Nicola, I've lived in my flat too long. if I'm honest, I'd really like to live in a house, but I haven't found one that's suitable at the price I can afford in the area where I want.
Yeah, typical dilemma.
Yes. So, convince me that it might be worth me paying some money to get a designer in to do stuff. What am I going to get from that?
Well, I think Toby touched on it a little bit as well. Like, the whole idea of having someone, not necessarily there to hold your hand, but to just bounce ideas off of and make sure that what your ideas are aren't completely crazy and, yeah, off the mark kind of thing. I mean, they'll probably come in and tell you that your pink kitchen is maybe a little bit outlandish, but you never know. You might get a nice peach kitchen instead. I don't know. So I think it's definitely worthwhile just even speaking to a designer and just bouncing ideas off of them. And then if you go forth with them, obviously designers have access to a lot of retailers and suppliers that, you know, aren't on the high street. So they have a lot of access to very interesting products that, you know, might work out great for your home. So it's definitely worthwhile putting in some time and effort with them.
It's interesting you mentioned suppliers. I mean, how do you go about finding new suppliers, Nicola? Is it simply a question of going online and just doing some research? You know, should we be relying on word of mouth from colleagues?
Well, I think it's a bit of what you just touched on. We've got a team of product specialists that go to all these different countries around the world, everywhere from China, Malaysia to Poland and Spain, and countries that are, and suppliers that are specifically known for certain products, and we'll source from them. And then we also go to a lot of the design shows where you do tend to find those really small boutique family-run businesses, and they might have that great dining chair and it's exactly what you've wanted for the past 2 years, and then, you know, you just sort of stumbled across it. So it's a little bit of luck, a little bit of research, and yeah, definitely word of mouth helps a lot.
Okay, well, fantastic. Lots of tips there for everybody. And that's it for this programme. And my thanks to my guests, Julian Morris, Nicola Geldart, Toby Scrutton, and to you for listening. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the programme. Maybe you'd like to leave a review as well on Audio Boom or iTunes. And would you be interested in joining a listeners panel? If so, please do get in touch via the website, which is insideproperty.org.uk. Inside Property is produced in collaboration with the National Landlords Association.